Save big money on your outdoor project at Menards. Take the guesswork out of landscaping with our free, easy-to-use design program. Plus, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape blocks at the best prices. Get started on your dream landscape now. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com to see our full selection of landscape blocks and get your project started today. Save big money
at Menards. Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Is the patient awake?
I don't know, it's my grandson. He's just...
Can you check for me if he's awake?
It's like he's gasping for air. He's done it yesterday, but he come round, but yeah, come around now.
And then he was fine all day because we took him shopping with us.
Wait.
And he was fine, perfect.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Seriously, that piece of footage that you've just seen is all you need to see to automatically recognise how guilty the individuals in this case clearly are. Don't get me wrong, they will deny, invent stories, fabricate reality, but you just need to see that tiny snippet to recognise just how predatorial these individuals are. And the case of Ethan Ives Griffiths is one of those that breaks your heart. Firstly, it's a child. What is going on in our world where children are murdered by the very people who are meant to protect them? But it's also just to do with the senselessness the violence involves. Now, we all know violent scenarios unravel at times, and it would be wonderful if we lived in a completely peaceful world. But when it's such senseless violence, because it's directed towards a child who can't defend themselves, it just brings into sharp focus how some individuals are apparently human, but are just so inhumane that they shouldn't be granted that title whatsoever. Let's talk about when this started to unravel, essentially. So the 14th of August, 2021, Kerry Ives makes a 999 call. And the reason she's doing that is she's reporting that her grandson, Ethan, had collapsed. And at this point, he was unresponsive. So this is where the case begins, I suppose, to spiral for the perpetrators. And it spirals in a horrific way because, unfortunately, Ethan actually dies 2 days after that call is made. And of course, at this moment in time, when they're dealing fundamentally with the death of a child, they're considering, is this accidental or is this something more sinister? And that's essentially what is going to play out in this case. The most sinister actions of individuals who are meant to protect this little boy. Let's talk about Ethan's mother. So Shannon Ives, she was the 28-year-old mother of Ethan Ives Griffiths. She's the only daughter of Michael and Kerry Ives. Now, she's originally from Wolverhampton, but did move to a house on Kingsley Road in Gardner City, Flintshire, which is in North Wales. Now, Shannon does allege that she suffered abuse at the hands of her parents when she was younger, and this would make sense, firstly, because some individuals who were abused at the hands of their parents don't actually see their parents as terrible human beings. The fact that parents are terrible human beings is irrelevant. The psychology of the child is, they are my parents. I am essentially, to some degree, their property. Shall we put it in that context, where they see themselves as an extension of these people's ownership? And therefore, when they want to harm them, they just acknowledge that they have a right to do so. Now, they don't, but very often the psychology of individuals will come to terms with their environment and at the hands of their caregivers being abused by believing that there must be a reason behind it. They justify the actions of those parents. And it sounds as if Shannon may well have done that, so she didn't necessarily seek the help that she should have deserved as a young child, getting the help that she required to actually prevent that abuse from playing out. And I have no doubt whatsoever, after seeing and hearing and researching about the parents in this case of Shannon, that they are absolute perpetrators at the highest level. So I do not doubt for one moment that she suffered abuse at their hands. I will, however, bring into question why she allowed those same people to harm her own child. Now, she ends up forming a relationship with a guy called Will Griffiths. He was from Mould in Flintshire. It didn't actually prove a positive relationship. It was very, very tumultuous. And again, we see very often with individuals who've been abused as children finding themselves in unsavoury relationships down the line because they think they only deserve that kind of relationship, which again is not true. They deserve good relationships, but the vulnerability is there and predators see that vulnerability. So the cycle of causation and that ripple effect is enormous where Shannon's own life is concerned. Now, Ethan is the little boy who Shannon gives birth to. This is in April 2019. And of course, Will Griffiths is the father. People who talk about this gorgeous little boy, they say he was a really bright-eyed, smiley toddler. He was described as really happy. And also, importantly, he was noted as being a relatively chubby little boy before he moves in with his grandparents in the middle of June 2021. Now, that's going to change significantly. But the reality is, before he goes and lives with the grandparents, he is considered somebody, shall we say, who's a little bit on the robust side weight-wise. There's nothing wrong with him. He's just got a little bit of puppy fat, but he's certainly under no circumstances whatsoever in a precarious situation health-wise with his weight. And what I would say is that move in the middle of June 2021 to his grandparents, who are meant to love and care and be compassionate towards him, that is going to prove the beginning of the end for him. And this little life that he experiences and endures is anything but easy. Now, Shannon and Ethan, they actually move out of the home that they shared with Will Griffiths on the 9th of June, 2021. And the reason for that is there was a domestic incident in which the police were called out. Now, Shannon had lived in different places with different people. She lived on occasion with her sisters, Nicole and Rachel Ives. But on the 24th of June 2021, Ethan ends up moving in with his grandparents, Michael and Kerry Ives. Now, Shannon does eventually go there in late July 2021. She moves in at that point too.
This Labor Day at Lowe's, shop member-only doorbuster deals for a limited time. Save $50 on an Ego string trimmer, now $169. Plus, get 50% off select Holland pavers. Not a rewards member? Sign up for free today. But hurry, Labor Day doorbuster deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 9-1 while supplies last. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
But you would expect in this interdependency model where different generations are being available to a child that that's a positive scenario. You know, that would fare well for this little boy, but it's going to do the absolute opposite. We get to the 6th of July 2021. Flintshire Social Services, they've actually at this point placed Ethan on the Child Protection Register. Now, going on the Child Protection Register means that a social worker needs to check on Ethan's welfare at least every 10 days. And there's a social worker assigned to his case, a guy called Michael Cornish. He visited the residence on the 22nd of July 2021. He did actually manage to see Ethan briefly. Ethan was in the back garden. Everything seemed okay. But after that particular visit, they basically, as a family, stonewall the social workers. So there are other attempts to see Ethan. 5th of August 2021, Michael Cornish comes for another scheduled visit. At this point, Shannon answers the door, basically says that Ethan's sleeping. And also, bear in mind, we are during the COVID pandemic scenario. So she also says, listen, my mum's tested positive for COVID, so we're all isolating in the house. Now, bear in mind, that means that the social worker is in a very difficult position because essentially entering the house when they're quarantined is probably not the protocol they're meant to follow. So even though they haven't seen Ethan, as far as they were concerned, on the first visit, everything was all right, and now there's a reason not to enter the home. Then we get to the 12th of August, 2021. Again, Cornish returns, brings a health visitor at this point as well, try to check on Ethan, but no one answers the door. Phone calls get unanswered, so they're not having any contact with the family, and Michael Cornish is really concerned. In fact, he's concerned enough that before he goes on leave, he emails his manager and says, listen, Ethan absolutely needs to be seen urgently. Tragically, that warning is going to come too late. And we often criticize social workers on this channel where failings have occurred. And it's really important as well to draw into sharp focus when somebody's doing a good job. Clearly, this is a very challenging time during COVID. This was a position where people could use an excuse as quarantine being the reason you don't get to see the child. People who were visiting homes were in a very precarious situation, knowing what to do was right or wrong. And this particular social worker absolutely went ahead and tried to visit at the reported times when they were meant to do so. And when it comes down to families just denying you entry through these excuses, it's very difficult to overcome that and to actually get yourself inside to see the child. And clearly this social worker did the best to do that. Now we get to the evening of the 14th of August 2021. This is when Kerry Ives makes that fateful call to 999 to basically report that Ethan has apparently, quote, collapsed whilst watching television. So yeah, as they do, if you've not got kids watching TV, just chilling out, collapsing every single day of the week, what's happening in your home? It makes no sense whatsoever. Kids don't just collapse this way. Now that call, it lasted about 13 minutes and Kerry basically tells the operator that Ethan is unresponsive. At one point, she actually says that his body's gone all limp. And in the background of the call, Michael Ives can be heard saying, "He looks like he's asleep." Now, let's just break that down. He looks like he's asleep. For any primary caregiver, and I'm using them as an example of primary caregiver because bear in mind, this child is living with them. So those people are meant to be overseeing his care and welfare. If you had watched a child apparently just watching TV collapse from nowhere, are you kidding me that you're going to be on a 999 call saying, "Oh, he looks like he's asleep"? You're not going to be like that at all. You'll be saying, "He's unconscious, he's unconscious." You're going to be freaking out massively. Now, bear in mind, we're meant to believe at this moment in time there's not been an accident, there's not been an apparent injury that this child has received. No, he's just collapsed out of the blue. And no mention is made of any accident or injury during that 999 call. Now the paramedics arrive and they immediately know that something terrible has happened to Ethan. Yes, he is absolutely unresponsive. They also noted straight away he looked like he was starving. He was painfully thin. Bear in mind what I said earlier on, that chubby little boy is now painfully thin. In fact, they said he looked like a 90-year-old man and he was covered in bruises. By this point, by the way, he looks like he's asleep, quote, because he's already in a coma. So when he gets to the hospital, he never regains consciousness from that point onwards. And initial assessments find out that he sustained an absolutely catastrophic head injury. In fact, his condition was so severe that on the Glasgow Coma Scale, and the Glasgow Coma Scale is basically a measure of consciousness, and the level of consciousness that's normally is 15, Ethan scored only a 7 when he was admitted to hospital. That indicates a really deep coma. It also demonstrates serious brain dysfunction. Now, the responding ambulance, they end up taking Ethan to the Countess of Chester Hospital. But bear in mind, his injuries are just so critical. He ends up getting transferred to Alderhay Children's Hospital in Liverpool. So Alderhay is a really renowned children's hospital in the north of England. And it's where they deal with the worst of worst scenarios for children in the northwest. Now, at this point, the doctors say that his physical condition is dire. He had multiple areas of bruising all across his body. And also, it was very obvious he was severely dehydrated. And we're talking about in the UK, we have tap water literally on tap. Everybody has it. They can't even cut you off, even if you're not paying your bills, because everyone deserves water. So there is absolutely no reason why a child would be severely dehydrated unless that child has purposefully and willfully been prevented from getting any hydration. Also, his lips were really badly cracked. He appeared very malnourished. And when they did scans on his brain, it revealed massive swelling, massive bleeding. In fact, one of the consultant pediatric neurosurgeons actually observed evidence of older brain bleeds as well. So yes, he had this acute injury, which clearly demonstrates it's come to some awful harm, but there are older bleeds in his brain. So obviously we are witnessing there sustained, consistent head trauma that has clearly occurred before the final collapse in that home. Also, that particular neurosurgeon described the swelling in Ethan's brain as being so extreme that it seemed he was, quote, having a stroke to a whole half of his brain. So basically, they said it was effectively cutting off function to one hemisphere. So you have a left and right hemisphere. Each area is very, very important to function so that our body works in the way that it works. It's also why when you have issues with one area of your hemisphere, so maybe your right hemisphere, you will lose certain functions in your body in the same with the left hemisphere. So this is what's happened. Basically, one of his hemispheres just isn't computing anything when they actually observe those scans. And the neurosurgeon knew straight away it's come from violence. So Ethan's either been shaken really vigorously or he's been struck with a significant force by an object. I suppose the other alternative is that somebody could be picked up by their feet and slammed against a hard object like a wall or the floor. Those kind of injuries are consistent with this kind of reality. Now, doctors at Alder Hey, they obviously fight desperately to save his life. In fact, they went so far as to prepare for a possible emergency surgery because they wanted to relieve pressure on Ethan's brain. So often what they'll do is they'll remove a piece of skull and that allows the brain to swell and it doesn't compress the breathing, because when your brain is swelling and your brain stem's getting affected and it's kind of reaching your skull area, it will cut off your ability to breathe. So they want to prevent that. But they never get the opportunity to, because the 16th of August 2021, this is 2 days after he's collapsed, he's pronounced dead. And whilst it could be possible, I suppose, to survive those kind of injuries and heal to some degree, one would imagine the impact of such a catastrophic brain injury would be profound when it came down to future disabilities and so on and so forth. And don't get me wrong, I wish that Ethan was alive and well and loved and looked after and cared for as he deserved to be. But I suppose that whilst you want a child always to live, when the consequences of them living is so distressing and relatively inhospitable for life for the rest of their life, to some degree, maybe it's a mercy that he didn't make it through. And that isn't to say for 1 minute that I wanted him to die. I didn't, clearly. But what I'm talking about is those kind of catastrophic injuries can lead to the most profound disabilities and a life basically needing round-the-clock care. And I think that that's very challenging for anyone to deal with, both the patient and the people who care for that patient. So essentially what happens is the doctors decided that life support needed to be withdrawn. They felt that future intervention would be futile. They didn't believe that he would survive his injuries. Now, the official cause of death was attributed to blunt force trauma that had led to a catastrophic brain injury consistent with inflicted abusive head trauma. So it's often actually that particular statement that I've read out associated with shaken baby syndrome. So catastrophic injuries caused to that little boy. Now, the medical findings at the hospital, of course, they don't really need to do that bigger investigation to recognise that we're talking about child abuse and that Ethan's condition, the fact that he had extreme dehydration, he had 40 separate injuries, signs of older trauma, which suggests consistent abuse. We know that they are going to be looking at that, recognising there's no innocent explanation whatsoever. It's utterly inconsistent with this being something that just happened because he collapsed. It's clearly abuse that lies at the heart of it. Now, hospital staff follow protocol. They inform the police immediately. At this point, investigators execute search warrants for the Ives house on Kingsley Road. And guess what? They discover that the home's got security cameras installed, and there's one that covers the back garden. I appreciate we're living in a day and age where we do often have CCTV at our homes, we have Ring doorbells and all the other things that go with it. And for the most part, that's good because it protects us. But there is something about the arrogance of perpetrators where they believe that they can treat anybody how they wish to treat them, and that they too can have things like CCTV in their home and it not come back to bite them on the bum. But of course, that's exactly what's going to happen in this case. And thank goodness that they have that arrogance to believe that they're always going to be able to get away with it. So they haven't dealt with the actual footage that's been recorded in their own home. Now, one clip, this is from the 4th of August 2021, so bear in mind that's about 10 days before Ethan's death. It literally shows that clip of Michael Ives picking Ethan up off a trampoline by the top of his arm, hoisting him into the air, and it was actually stated that they did that as if he were just a bag of rubbish to be slung out. Now, that footage literally shows that Ethan's really unsteady on his feet, He's on the trampoline. He's finding it difficult to stand up. Sometimes he'd just lie on his side and the other kids would be bouncing around him. Now, bear in mind, if you're watching a child in that situation, I have a two-year-old daughter. So if she was on a bouncy castle or a trampoline and there are bigger kids around her and she's trying to stand up and she's struggling, I am going to go and relieve her of being in that scenario because I don't think it's safe for her. That's what a carer would do. But that's not what Michael Ives does. In fact, he sees this as a perfect opportunity to mock Ethan. At one point, he points a garden hose at Ethan and actually pretends that he might spray him, which clearly causes Ethan distress. So he's humiliating this beautiful little boy who's already physically not in a good way. What does that tell you about the predatory mindset of this perpetrator? He's enjoying torturing this defenseless child, a child who cannot do anything to combat that reality. They are completely unable to fight for themselves. They require others to fight for them, but quite the contrary is playing out in this situation. Now, in another clip, Michael literally forces Ethan to stand in a stress position, so he has to place his hands on top of his head. Also, he's captured gesturing to another child to come over and to punch Ethan. Now, that video actually shows that child obediently hitting Ethan several times on the head as Michael looks on. Now, that is because that child knows if he probably says no, he's going to get punched by Michael. So this is how that perpetuation of abuse plays out in wider families. Everyone's so terrified of the main perpetrator and aggressor that people will just bow to whatever they're being told to do to prevent themselves from getting harmed. But what kind of a psyche does Michael Ives have to do that? This is a little tiny child. And he's demanding that another bigger child comes over and beats that little boy. And even when that's playing out in front of him, does he intervene? Does he stop? Does he say, oh no, this has gone too far? No, he just watches. Also, neither Kerry nor Shannon, who were sometimes clearly very close to where Ethan was, actually intervened to protect Ethan. So this little boy is being beat senseless, being abused, being tortured, being humiliated. And the mother and the grandmother are just standing by, allowing it to happen. And I do appreciate that some of you very compassionate people will be saying, well, the truth is, Emma, when it comes down to it, it could be that Kerry and Shannon are so terrified of this man that they don't necessarily want to intervene because they fear that things could go wrong for themselves. Well, no, I don't buy into that. I don't have that compassion. These are grown adults. Yes, they're females, but they've got hands and they can ring the emergency services. They can ask for help. They're allowing this child to be brutalized. And in doing that, they are complicit in this abuse. And then in one clip, Shannon, so the mother herself, she actually joins in with this brutality, as far as I'm concerned, this humiliation. She gets on the trampoline. She deliberately bounces while Ethan, who can barely stand up, is on it. And it just means that he keeps falling over. That is not funny. He's not laughing. That child is in distress. And the one person who should be protecting him at all costs is his mother. And she does the opposite. She joins in the cruelty. Now, this evidence was actually pivotal because this exposes lies that Michael and Kerry are initially telling the authorities. So they maintain that nothing had happened. Ethan had simply fallen ill, he'd collapsed without warning. They didn't know what on earth had occurred. They couldn't do anything to prevent what played out because he just got sick. They completely denied abusing him. They also said that those bruises on his body were just due to the fact that he was accident prone. He walks into things. Now again, I do appreciate, my mother tells a story of the fact when I was a child, they actually sent somebody to visit my parents' home because I was constantly at hospital. I was always falling off things because I liked to climb and do things that I was told not to do. I did apparently once manage to get into a packet of pills and eat those. The doctor said, it'll be fine, she'll sleep it off. And my mum said, the irony was, you didn't even sleep. You just carried on being the mischievous little soul that you were. So I am already today covered in bruises. I am the person who bangs into everything. I get it. But when it is a young child, if you do have a child that is really super accident prone, and we're talking about 40 very visible injuries on this child's body, including brain bleeds as well, clearly that isn't coming from him banging into things. But they're clearly trying to put this story across that he's just his accident-prone child and he's caused it all himself. So they're actually victim-blaming as well. Now, medical experts, they say, no, absolutely not. There is no way this is just down to accidents. There's no way that he just collapsed, because we know the head injury that Ethan sustained that basically was responsible for his death happened literally just moments before he collapsed. So they're basically saying that one of the two adults who were present either violently hit him or shook him. And they know at this point that Shannon was upstairs, so she was present in the house, but she likely wasn't present when that injury occurred. Now, unfortunately, there wasn't actually a camera in the living room, so the police don't know exactly what happened. But ultimately, they know that something happened to that little boy that wasn't accidental, and it was caused by one of these two adults. Now, on the 21st of September 2021, North Wales Police, they publicly announced that three individuals have been charged in relation to Ethan's death. And the case obviously moves more slowly at this point through the justice system because COVID was playing out. So there were delays. And also, let's be honest, when you're putting together a case, you need to make sure that that case is going to get the desired effect, which is a guilty verdict where these perpetrators are concerned. So it actually takes till the 4th of March 2024 for all three individuals to be formally charged. Now, at this point, all of them pled not guilty. Just what we expect. Par for the course where these kind of perpetrators are concerned. They always believe they can beat the system, don't they? We've got this child who's got these multiple injuries clearly inflicted by adult hands, and it goes without saying that they're the only people who are capable of doing that because they are the only ones who had access to him at this point, and yet still they're going to go for their, well, it wasn't me, maybe it was her, well, it wasn't her, maybe it was him, and that's the way they're going to play it. Now, Michael and Kerry, the grandparents in this case, they were charged with murder, causing or allowing a child to suffer serious physical harm, causing assault, ill treatment, neglect, and abandonment of a child to cause unnecessary suffering. And Shannon Ives, the mother in this case, she was not charged with murder, but she was charged with causing or allowing a child to suffer serious physical harm, causing assault, ill treatment, neglect, and abandonment of a child to cause unnecessary suffering. Shannon actually got bail, but her parents were remanded in custody, and rightly so. We don't want murderers walking the streets. Now, the reason that all three of them were tried together in a single trial was because the evidence presented against all three was basically really intertwined, so separate trials may have led to inconsistent verdicts. So instead, it means that they're going to hear all the evidence and all the kind of spider web of connection in that one trial. It makes it easier when the verdicts are concerned. Now, the trial began on the 4th of June 2025 at Mole Crown Court. The judge presiding over the case was Mr. Justice Martin Griffiths, and the prosecution was led by Caroline Rees. Rees actually is a real specialist. She specialises in serious criminal cases, which include child abuse homicides. Where the defence was concerned, they had three different individuals representing each of the perpetrators. So Michael was represented by David Elias, Kerry was represented by Owen Edwards, and Shannon was represented by Gordon Cole. Now, the prosecution, they argue that Ethan was subjected to casual brutality. And I think that's such an important way of phrasing it. Casual brutality, that it was so endemic within the psyches and character and actions of these perpetrators that it was just second nature. Because the word casual and brutality, it's a paradox, it's a juxtaposition, isn't it? But actually, when you really listen to what they're stating there, they're stating that psychologically, these people were so used to being brutal, were so used to being negative, were so used to being hostile and aggressive, that they could just go about their business beating a child in a casual manner as far as they're concerned, because it's just par for the course. It's so normal. And I find it so powerful using words that would not usually be associated in this manner when it comes down to the prosecution. And that casual brutality was played out basically by his grandparents. They said it was a house of horrors and that Ethan suffered distress, pain and misery in the days and weeks prior to his death. And we're talking about a toddler. Just let that sink in. This is a little tiny child.
And these grown adults are basically torturing him, humiliating him, distressing him, beating him. And this is going on for a long period of time. Now, the prosecution are very clear. They believe that Michael and Kerry Ives were directly responsible for physically abusing Ethan and also directly responsible for murdering him. But they also want to make it clear that Shannon, the mother in this case, is absolutely complicit. They say that she was willfully allowing the abuse. She did nothing to stop it. And by failing to act, she acted in an abusive manner. And rightly so, that is absolutely correct. Now, Rees told the jury that only Michael and Kerry were present at the critical moment of collapse. They also said that the overwhelming expert evidence showed that Ethan's fatal injury was caused by deliberate force within minutes of his collapse. So clearly, the suggestion there is, yes, Shannon, the mother in this case, was complicit by not protecting him and by allowing this abuse to play out. But you can't pin it on her because we know that Kerry and Michael were the people present at that moment when the injury was sustained. So they are the people in the line of fire. And understandably, the defence where Shannon is concerned is going to use that very, very effectively to demonstrate the difference between her role and their role. Now, when it came down to Michael and Kerry's defence, there wasn't really one, was there? Just going to throw it out there. I can imagine getting this case as a defence barrister and being like, I'm really sorry, does the clerk hate me? Does the clerk who assigns these cases despise me? Because why have I got this one? Because genuinely, if you read into this, there is no defence whatsoever. It's indefensible. So I guess that the defence lawyer is sitting there going, well, I just blame the other person. Just blame the other person. And we'll just deny it as well. We'll just deny it happened. And then we'll throw blame at somebody else. And we'll just hope it'll stick. Because that is genuinely all they have opportunity-wise to them. So Michael and Kerry's defence, they basically have this mixture of denial and blame shifting. So both Michael and Kerry are, of course, denying murdering Ethan. They're like, we didn't kill him. It's just some kind of injury. Yeah, it's an injury. And also, you can't really say it was definitely us because we might have been there, but it could have been someone else. I'm not even joking. That's literally how they played it. So yeah, basically they're saying it could have been an accident. Shannon could have caused it. And you haven't actually got us banged to rights. It's not on CCTV. As if that's the way the world works. As if everything has to be on CCTV for you actually to be considered the people who are responsible for something terrible happening to another human being. But that's the way they are playing it. They're saying there's no eyewitnesses, there's no CCTV, and therefore you can't absolutely quantify that they are responsible for it. Also, the defence goes, you know that footage, that garden footage that kind of makes Michael look like the nasty murdering predator he is. Well, we're just going to say, you know, he might be a bit of a bully, but that doesn't mean he's a killer. Sorry, just run that through me again. What we're saying is, you know that footage? Yeah, the really incriminating footage where basically he's violently abusing a child. Yeah, that is a lot of language that seems inflammatory, I'm going to say. You know, have you got any evidence that he was really being that abusive? Yes, it's on video. Okay, but just maybe change your language. Oh, no, I'm not going to change my language because he's massively abusive. Just get back to the point that I'm making. I'm saying, is he a killer or is he just a massive, nasty bully who's basically using his physical dominance to aggress a small child? Yeah, that is what I'm saying, but I'm also saying chain of causation and cycle of perpetuation would suggest that your client has the capacity to do really terrible things because, as you've just highlighted, he's bullying a small child. Yeah, I'm not thinking my defence is working out quite as well as I imagined. Anyway, that's what's playing out in that moment. It's just bizarre that the defence is like, yeah, look, he's a horrible bully, but that doesn't make him a killer. Well, it kind of makes him a lot more likely to be a killer compared to, I don't know, somebody like me, who you would never get on CCTV doing anything like that. Now, of course, what does Shannon's defence do? Well, they're like, listen, this girl has got nothing to do with the parents. Again, I'm not sure that's going to work. Let's just stop it. Just listen to me. Let's go down this trajectory where I'm trying to make it out that this girl who basically was complicit isn't complicit. Right, okay, go on, hit me with your best. Well, what I'm saying is she was upstairs when this child was murdered by this couple. Okay, she was upstairs knowing that her parents, who were very violent by her own admission, were given access to a child that they are dangerous around, that she's witnessed them being dangerous around, and that she's actually joined in the cruelty toward in the garden, on the trampoline, all of those things. So how is it going to work that you're defending that? I'm saying that as her defence, she was upstairs, they were downstairs, she doesn't really even know them. They're actually her parents. Let's just separate them. Are they her parents? Yeah, they are definitely her parents. Well, I mean, again, we've not done a DNA test. We're just saying that she and they are quite separate, in the same house, definitely involved in the child's life together, definitely all abused the child. But aside from that, let's just separate them entirely, recognising that Shannon is a completely autonomous, independent individual who wasn't involved in any way, shape or form in the actual killing of her own child. Yeah, but she was involved in all the rest of it. Fair point, she was. Yeah, she was. Anyway, just drives me mad because it's so easy to unpick, isn't it, this kind of defence. But like I said, this is what the defence will try to do. They want to separate her. They want to make sure that she isn't painted as equally culpable in the eyes of the jury. They want to make the jury feel sorry for her with respect. So they're highlighting her youth. They're talking about the psychological control her parents had over her. I can absolutely concede that there will be a level of psychological control because of the abuse that she's suffered in the past and because she will fear repercussions potentially from her father in particular. But don't go back to live with your abusive parents. Don't involve yourself in the abuse of your own child. I'm sorry, the moment that she's making those choices, she is underpinning the accessibility that they had to this child and also the permission base that she's allowing them to go ahead and carry out such levels of absolute inconceivable harm to her own son. So she's entirely culpable. She also said that she had never inflicted any serious injury on Ethan. So she's positioning herself and her defence are positioning her as a secondary party who, yes, failed her duty, but had absolutely no idea how bad things would get. Now, the prosecution, I would say, had a pretty, pretty impactful case, genuinely. Even from what I've talked about so far, guys, I am pretty sure that all of you could form an argument as to why these individuals are culpable, why they murdered this child, and why one of the defendants is certainly guilty of serious neglect and allowing their child to be harmed because of her own actions and failure of actions, which is, of course, Shannon in this case. But when it comes down to the prosecution, they did a good job. So one of the things that happens is Jones reads out texts from the defendant. So on the 20th of July, 2021, Shannon messages a relative to say she is, quote, sick of speaking to Ethan. Just sick of speaking to my own child. Why? Well, because I'm an absolute waste of human space. Sorry, that's the only reason why any mother would say that about their own beautiful child. Now, she's asked why, and she says, just won't listen as usual. He's a toddler. Toddlers are blessed with this capacity to not be deaf. They're just ignoring you. It's as simple as that. They have hearing issues. They just don't want to listen. They're a child. They're in the child's world. They're thinking about more important things than responding to an adult. But this bothers her massively and frustrates her, and that gives us a line and direction as to how she feels about her son. Now, on the 24th of June, 2021, Shannon actually messages a mother, Kerry, to say, CBA today, can't be asked today. I don't think that Shannon was asked pretty much 24/7 when it came down to caring for her own baby. We get to the 13th of August, 2021. At this point, Shannon texts a Flying Star health visitor, Ellie Jones, and says that Ethan's, quote, really poorly. Now, the health visitor messages back, says, hope Ethan is okay. Does he need to see a doctor? Shannon says, no, it's because he's not getting enough sleep. Just been giving him Calpol. Now, the irony is she's been texting that to this health visitor is obviously concerned and wants to make sure that Ethan's okay. But CCTV footage actually shows that at that point, Ethan was in fact in Tesco in Broughton with Michael and Kerry. So Shannon is cultivating a web of lies and making this particular health visitor think, oh, she's a caring mother, she's concerned, she's getting in contact with me, when actually this kid's in Tesco. Now, DC Harshi Jones, who also came into court to give evidence, provided the court with CCTV footage from the front of the Ives house. This is where they see Michael Ives carrying Ethan by an arm and literally putting him into a car on the 12th of August 2021. Just think about that. Picking your child up or your grandchild up by one arm, just carrying them like a piece of baggage and then putting them in the car. That demonstrates a level of failure of care that's enormous. And one of the things that's said is there appeared to be two downward motions by Michael inside the car. Prosecution said that was because Michael was punching Ethan twice. Could they be any more diabolical? And the answer is yes, they can, and they are. Also shown to the jury was CCTV footage from the Ives back garden. This is when Ethan's on a trampoline. This is not long before his death on the 16th of August. Now, bear in mind, there was a paddling pool in the garden near the trampoline. Michael turns the hose towards Ethan. He's obviously on the trampoline, and he turns that hose on him for 8 seconds. Now, bear in mind, that means the trampoline is very wet. He's already unsteady on his feet. It's meant to be a place where he's enjoying playing, and instead he's been basically humiliated by being sprayed with water for 8 seconds. He's now really unsteady and he's struggling. Now, at this point, another kid just runs onto the trampoline, makes Ethan bounce, takes his hands off his head, because of course we know that Michael Ives wanted Ethan to have that stress experience of having his hands on his head constantly. But even though it gets him unsteady and he takes his hands off his head, he immediately puts them back on his head because he knows he's being watched by Michael. That's indicative of a child who is regularly being abused. They know the consequences. They're terrified of the perpetrator. So even when they've not caused the hands to come off the head, because another child's the causation of that, immediately they're looking for that perpetrator. They're putting the hands back on their head. They're desperate not to offend the person who can cause them more damage. And it's heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking. This is a baby. It's as simple as that, a young toddler. And that is their psychology, that they have to be afraid constantly. Now, court were also shown body cam footage of Michael and Kerry's accounts from the 15th of August 2021. Michael says Ethan was playing about, said he took his eyes off him for not even 30 seconds, and then he noticed he was on the floor face down on the left side. Now, just think about that. Just be real. You've not taken your eyes off him for more than 30 seconds, but it's in this unbelievable small window of opportunity that somehow this child has had a catastrophic brain injury. How convenient. The other 24 hours, pretty much, you were watching him. But just those 30 seconds in the 24 hours, you took your eyes off him, and now he's got an injury that's going to kill him. He also says that he picked Ethan up and that Ethan was very floppy, but then he came around and he said he was apparently fine all day, perfect, playing about, having his food and all that. And then he said they put a film on because obviously they were a loving, connected family who were going to sit down and watch a movie together. And he said at this point, he was watching Ethan and he could see that his legs were going. But fortunately, Michael, being the hero in this moment, manages to catch Ethan before he hits the floor. Then, in no doubt a loving tone, he says, "Stand up, lad, come on." Takes him outside to get some fresh air like any good granddad would do. But then apparently Ethan wasn't having any of it. He also was asked to describe Ethan. And Michael said, "When he's good, you couldn't ask for a better kid." Just going to throw it out there. Any adult parent in the history of adult parents would say, when he's good, you can't get better. Because any kid who's being good is being good. But essentially, again, the intonation is, but when he's bad, he's very, very bad. That's what's being said in that moment. He also said that he could walk, but he was really clumsy. And if he was walking on his own, he'd fall. So the very fact that they've suggested he was constantly having accidents, but then by their own admission is saying he's not safe to walk by himself because he constantly is falling, that would again be a failure of care. That would be neglectful. If you knew that and you're allowing him to walk around by himself so he's constantly falling and banging into things, you are making an active choice to prevent him from having a safe environment by being present with him when he's trying to walk. Now, Kerry, she again is going down there, oh, we've got no idea what happened, Ruth. So she said, nothing out of the ordinary happened on the 13th of August. Ethan was laughing in the trolley in Tesco with her and Michael. Yeah, he's having a whale of a time, of course. Not a problem, no issues whatsoever. So they aren't just pretending that they haven't got involved in any kind of abuse. They're now trying to introduce the fact that this boy is just having a right old great time, even though we know he's got previous brain bleeds going on. So the last thing this emaciated, dehydrated child is feeling is fun and laughter. But this is the story they're trying to put across in a way of denying that they've had any involvement in what's played out in his death, or at least in what they consider is a very serious accident at this moment in time. Now, when they got home, apparently Ethan had ate a chocolate bar. He'd had some juice, even though we know he was dehydrated and emaciated. On the 14th of August, Kerry actually said that Ethan had, quote, gone to fall back, but Michael caught him and then he just flopped in Michael's arms. So very much mirroring the same story that Michael is telling. She also noted that Ethan wasn't responsive, that the paramedics came in and then took him in the ambulance. She said it happened all so quickly. She also described Ethan as a happy little boy and a good, healthy kid. Well, maybe he was those things until you got hold of him. But both of these perpetrators are just lying through their teeth. And the weird thing is imagining that other people will fall in line, that people will believe this BS story that they're telling. Also, again, just really reinforcing that he was drinking, he was eating, saying that he was drinking out of his beaker of juice. She also said he did have a big temper and apparently he could throw himself on the floor and scream. Well, we all know, anybody who's had a two-year-old, that's why we call it the terrible twos. That's why when they get to three, we call them three-nagers, because they are finding their sense of self, and part of that is learning to say no, and part of that is resisting particular things that they're being told to do. Part of that is demonstrating their unhappiness, and sometimes they will throw themselves on the floor. But they don't give themselves catastrophic brain injuries because they figure out pretty quickly how much it hurts when they throw themselves on the floor, and they decide exactly how they're going to do it in a safe way. They don't want to cause themselves injury. But yes, again, throwing out there that this is just the child who's caused these issues and not them, the perpetrators themselves. Now, Josh Ives is brought into court. This is Michael and Kerry's son. And he actually says, listen, they hit me growing up. They also hit Shannon. So basically, that's very powerful testimony. Their own son is giving evidence saying they were abusive towards him. Also, they bring in Angela Harrison. Now, she worked at Plas Bellin Hall in Mull from 2015 until it closed in 2023. Now, Plas Bellin, it was a supportive accommodation, essentially. So if you were homeless or if you were at risk of being homeless, you could end up going there. Referrals had come from Flintshire County Council. Now, Shannon, she moved in to Plas Bellin in 2017. Ethan was born in April 2019. This is when she was living there. Now, this particular worker was really worried about Shannon. She felt that she didn't abide by the rules. First of all, she would drink. That was against the rules of Plas Bellin. It's a dry site. She also said that in 2020, Shannon left Ethan unattended for 17 minutes. Now, that came about because another resident heard Ethan crying, reported it, and they discovered that he'd just been left by himself. So immediately, we're seeing a very neglectful parent. Then the health visitor in Mould, a woman called Judith Froggatt, she testifies. Now, she's somebody who's dealt with Shannon. She said that Shannon had indeed talked about the fact that she had a very negative childhood. She described that childhood as being chaotic. She said that she was really frightened of her dad. and that she had indeed experienced physical abuse from him. Then there's a nursing sister at Alder Hey who's brought into court, a woman called Lauren Jones. She worked in the paediatric unit in August 2021. She'd been a nurse for 8 years at that time. And she was the person who was working in the early hours of the 15th of August. And it's at this point they're informed a, quote, time-critical head trauma patient was being transferred from Chester. She said that aside from obviously you're always shocked about a child in a critical condition being brought in, what really got her was just how sick he looked. He looked emaciated. He looked malnourished. She said he looked more like a one-year-old. She also recalled the injuries that he received. These included bruising to the left side of the cheek, which looked like three fingerprints. So one of the things that we look for in safeguarding where child protection issues are concerned is fingerprint injuries, because understandably it means somebody's grabbing your face or grabbing your arms, and that's indicative of abuse. She also said he had bruising on his arm, his leg, and his chest. She also said that he was missing a chunk in his lip. Now, Shannon, the mother in this case, apparently had said this is because he bit his lip, but I think we can all assume it's more likely that he'd been horribly abused. Shannon also tried to say that Ethan had been eating normally. Lauren, who was working as a medical expert at this point, said, absolute rubbish. There is absolutely no way I believe that. And said, it was really upsetting to see a child looking that underweight. And I think that we often forget, don't we, these experts that are brought to care for these children, they're also human beings. They're going home to their own kids. And seeing a child who basically looks like they've been in a prisoner of war camp, because that's the way somebody looks in that moment, a starving child, particularly in Western Britain, you have to think to yourself, wow, how is that going to land and impact those individuals? Because no one should witness a child in the UK that underweight, that malnourished, that dehydrated, along with all the other terrible things that had happened to this boy. But that's the reality. He looks that bad. Now, Sasha Bateman, she worked at the ICU at Alder Hey in August 2021. She came into court and said that Ethan was very small and underweight. So he had an awful lot of bruising on his body, a large tummy and a bandage on his head. She said you could see his ribs. There was also, again, fingerprint bruising that she saw on Ethan's left cheek, as well as a chipped front tooth. She also said that his lips were very, very dry, very scabby and had dry blood on them. She actually said she'd never seen anything like that in person before. Also noted that Shannon, the mother in this case, was quiet and withdrawn, but didn't ask any questions about Ethan, which is really out of context. It's really atypical. If your child has apparently collapsed of something that no one is aware of at this moment in time, you're going to be asking questions 10 to the dozen. It's as simple as that. But she's not asked any questions. Why is that? Because she knows exactly what's happened to her son. Also, it was noted that she was constantly on her phone, that she wasn't really aware of things that were going on around her. But that particular expert said she did remember Shannon moving a chair closer to Ethan and at one point holding his hand. But there were certainly some atypical actions that really stayed with that worker that fell out of context with how a mother should be. Now, another nurse on the critical care unit at Alder Hey, a woman called Catherine Morledge, she talked to the court about her first experience of Ethan, was that he was really skinny. He was possibly malnourished. He appeared really dirty. And again, validated that Shannon was on the phone. She wasn't interacting with Ethan at all. So just validating what that other person has said, that she's acting completely at odds with how normal mothers are in these situations. Now, a statement was read out to the court from Dr. Carla Thomas. That was the first consultant who was on call at paediatric unit at Alder Hey. She said that Ethan underwent an urgent operation to remove part of his skull. He was suffering from multi-organ systems failure, so very, very seriously unwell. Everything's shutting down, kidneys, liver, etc. Now, Dr. Jayaratnam Jayamohan, paediatric neurosurgeon from Alder Hey Hospital, he gave testimony via video link, and he explained the nature of Ethan's head injury and also the presence of older injuries, and said it was clear there were repeated assaults over a prolonged period of time, said that this included older brain bleeds, also anemia consistent with internal bleeding. God bless this little boy. Also noted that by the time of Ethan's surgery, that everything was stacked against his survival. So it was a long shot them doing any surgery on him. Now, of course, when it came down to the defence, well, they didn't have a lot really to go on, did they? Let's be clear. But Michael Ives does take the stand. And guess what he came dressed in? Because you're in court, you're in a court of law. Your job in a court of law is to present the jury with the belief that you are not a waste of human space. And believe me, mate, you had a long distance to travel to change the opinion of the jury at this moment in time with all the evidence that's been presented. But this doesn't deter him. He's like, what shall I go for? What shall I wear today? Shall I wear that nice navy suit with a nice crisp white shirt, maybe a black tie? You know, something that suggests I'm understanding the professional environment and the very serious environment I'm about to enter. Didn't get that memo. Wore a blue tracksuit. I kid you not. A blue tracksuit. Also, tells the court that he was born on the 9th of September 1977 in Wolverhampton. Talks about himself being the eldest of four brothers. Talked about the fact he lived with his mum and dad, moved into care, and then later went and lived with his grandma. Said he started living on his own about the age of 16. At this point, he began a relationship with Kerry, who was aged 18 at the time. And in fact, quite quickly, Shannon is born when he and Kerry are still living in a hostel in Wolverhampton together. Now, they are quite transient. There's quite a few moves across North Wales. And at this point, Michael and Kerry eventually moved into the address in Garden City in 2019. Ethan, of course, moves in with them on the 24th of June, 2021. And the reason for that, Michael said, was that Shannon had asked if they could look after him. Now, while we know that Shannon then moves in as well, they also noted that Ethan at this point would sleep in a travel cot in the living room. Said that Ethan was apparently whingy when he first came, but they put that down to him missing his mum. And also he said that he didn't actually need to discipline Ethan initially because Ethan was really good. But obviously the indication there is that he did eventually decide that he needed to discipline Ethan. He also kind of blamed Shannon for being quick-tempered, said she was physical with Ethan because, of course, they're trying to suggest that maybe she was the person responsible. She said that as a mother, she would slap him on the back of the head, legs and backside, apparently a couple of times a day, but apparently it varied. He also said that Ethan would apparently start laughing at her after he'd been slapped, and that just made Shannon more angry, and then she'd scream at him. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't meet many kids who laugh when a primary caregiver clouts them. Usually, you'll see that they do quite the contrary. Now, don't get me wrong, there are some children who are very nervous when you're going to strike them, and they might laugh initially, but as soon as that hit occurs, they tend to get very upset. He also, this is, of course, Shannon's father saying this about her. So this is something that just demonstrates the failure to protect on every level, because this guy, as Shannon's father, should be ready to die for her. But here he is throwing her under the bus in court. He says that not only did she slap him on his bottom and legs, she'd also slap Ethan on the mouth. And this is if he bit his lip. And that he would basically be the hero in this situation. He'd bathe Ethan's lip in salt water a couple of times a day so that it didn't get infected. I mean, could he be any more of a liar? It is unbelievable, isn't it? He also said, I did pull her up on it. And I said, you shouldn't be doing that. And she would reply to him, mind your own business. Of course, I mean, that just makes sense, doesn't it? Everybody's admitted how scared they are of Michael from her own experience of him as a father, her brother's experience of him as a father, the way he's treated her own son. But this man is standing in court basically saying, I'm a good guy. I really cared about Ethan. I wanted to make sure he wasn't getting hurt by his own mother. I kept pulling her up on those things. I mean, it's just absolute BS. Now, when Kerry Ives took the stand, she was asked, did you assault Ethan on the 14th of August? She said, of course, no. She denied seeing, assisting or encouraging the assault. She also denied using a belt or punching her children and said that she never saw Michael do that either. She also said that her son Josh was wrong because he accused her and Michael of hitting him and that it apparently wasn't true. Again, this doesn't look good for her in court because clearly on video, we can see how violent they are towards Ethan. So it's not hard to stretch our imagination to imagine that they were violent towards their own biological children too. She also said that Ethan was fun to be around and a bubbly little child. Could she be any more stereotypical in her descriptions? She also said that she noticed a change in Ethan when Shannon came to live with them. So again, Shannon's back in the line of fire. And she said, you know, Shannon used to smack Ethan up the head. And she's asked, okay, why did she do that? And Kerry said, well, he probably pissed her off by laughing at her. She used to smack his hand and smack his bum. So again, towing the party line, which her husband is also doing, telling the same story. Now, when she was asked about that CCTV footage, the highly incriminating CCTV footage, the footage that demonstrates what horrible human beings you are, she's basically asked, what do you think of how Michael handled Ethan? She said, okay, it was cruel. A little bit of an understatement there. That should have just played up in court, just the big words in red, just understatement, understatement, understatement. Also, she said, oh, you know what, though? I didn't see it at the time. I was just too busy doing, you know, something else around the house. Could you describe what you were doing? No, just be something else. What? Something else. Just something where I was really busy doing something. Around somewhere, in the house, but just basically not anywhere in the vicinity of where this might have happened. So I can't really say anything because I was just so busy doing other things. Now, during cross-examination, you can imagine the person who's actually going to do this rubbing their hands together, because Gordon Cole, who's Shannon's defence, they are clearly trying to show that she treated her son very differently from how the grandparents treated him. So they basically bring up the CCTV footage from the 4th of August and say, you know, you're saying that you're busy in the house elsewhere. And obviously we know Kerry's like, yes, I was very busy elsewhere. He says, well, you were actually staring and looking at Michael carrying Ethan by the arm. You said you didn't see it. I put it to you, that's a lie. You could clearly see him and you watched. Now, she's asked at this point, why did you lie to the jury? And she said, I can't answer that. I kid you not. Can you believe the gall of this woman? She even in the moment where she is caught in the headlights, cannot just admit to what she did. Cannot just say, oh, at the end of the day, I didn't want to acknowledge what I saw because I should have done more. No, she just says, I can't answer that. Well, you can. You're just a massive liar. But no. She can't answer that. During that cross-examination, it was also put to her that someone in that room on the 14th of August did something to cause Ethan to have a fatal injury. Kerry agreed with this. And they said, well, who was it? And she said, it wasn't me or Michael. Again, just willing to throw the daughter, who clearly wasn't responsible for the injury, under the bus. Also, again, said there was nothing wrong with Ethan before his collapse. When she was asked why she never did anything about the way that Michael handled Ethan, her answer was, he's not going to listen to me, is he? He's a fully grown man. Nobody ever listens to me. Oh, woe is you. She also accepted, however, that she didn't do anything to stop the treatment of Ethan. She also said that she regretted that now. Just a little bit too late, isn't it, Kerry? Now, when it came down to Shannon Ives, she said that her parents were horrible in the way that they disciplined me growing up. She said they were abusive. She said she'd get punched and kicked. She'd get a belt used on her. And she said the abuse started when she was about 4. She said it was mainly Michael who was abusive, but Kerry would hit her now and again. She also admitted that she was frightened of her dad and that he would hit her daily and call her a slag. Wow. Michael sounds like the kind of guy you would like to bring round to your home and then incinerate. Sorry, that's just my fantasy going off down my fantasy lane again. But you know what I'm saying? This guy is everything that is wrong with a human being. But also, I don't have any sympathy for Shannon in this moment. She took her child into the lion's den and she left him there of her own volition, knowing what could play out and what could occur when it came down to the abuse that she herself had encountered in that home. She also mentioned that when Ethan first lived with his grandparents without her, that he didn't seem himself, that he was dead quiet. Also said that Michael and Kerry would make up excuses when she asked to go and see him. and that she'd basically have to sit outside in the back garden when she went round. Then when she moved into her parents' home, she noticed that Ethan was skinny, quiet and withdrawn, and apparently that upset her, but not enough to protect him. She also told the court that when he had left her, he was chubby. And obviously we know that he was emaciated by the time he died. But that begs the question, when she moved in, why didn't you make sure he was eating well? She also did concede that she had seen Michael making Ethan stand with his hands on his head. She'd also admit that she did smack him on his hands or his bottom. She also said that on reflection, her father's treatment of her son was very upsetting, and that she didn't say anything at the time because she was scared of her dad. So even though she'd witnessed these horrible abusive episodes, she didn't know how to handle it. Well, I'm sorry, that's not good enough, with respect, at all. Makes you complicit. She also said she never hurt Ethan. And when she was asked about the bruises that were seen on Ethan's body, she said, no, it was that Michael, her father, would tell her that he'd just fallen over or he'd walked into something, and she'd just conveniently believe that. She did, however, confirm an event on the 13th of August 2021. This is when Ethan had collapsed or been found unresponsive the day before the final incident, but he did regain consciousness. She said that during this event, even though he'd obviously been badly injured to the point of unconsciousness, instead of calling 999, the family took Ethan out to Tesco. I mean, could you be any more neglectful? The child has passed out due to a horrible injury, because without a doubt, that's what occurred that day, the day before he died, the day before the next horrendous injury. But instead of calling 999, once he's kind of come round, they're like, let's go out to Tesco. Now, at this point in court, Shannon said, I should have got medical attention for Ethan. I should have done what a mum should do. Yeah, you should have. But you're not really a mum, are you? Because, you know, we can dress her up however we wish. Shannon's still a horrendous abuser. She also blamed her parents, said that she was under their control and influence. And she said, I was also made to lie to social workers. So, for example, pretending that Kerry had COVID. She also said that she'd begun to form an idea that her parents were responsible for Ethan's death when she got home from Alderhay Hospital. She said they were the only ones in the room with him. She also said that she'd seen Michael shake Ethan outside on the afternoon of August the 14th. She said he grabbed Ethan by the arms and then pulling and pushing back in one movement. So basically just being very aggressive with him. You won't be surprised to know that when it came down to the verdict on the 15th of July 2025, the jury actually deliberated for 6 hours and 54 minutes over 2 days, and they reached a unanimous decision on all counts. Michael and Kerry were indeed found guilty of the murder of their grandson, Ethan. They were also found guilty of cruelty to a child under 16 for the prolonged abuse they inflicted. Shannon Ives, she was found guilty of causing or allowing the death of a child and guilty of child cruelty by neglect. Amen to all of those verdicts. Amen. Now, I haven't got the sentencing yet. That's going to take place at Mould Crown Court on the 3rd of October 2025. But let's hope that they get a very long sentence in prison and they get to really repent at leisure for their sins. Now, when that verdict came out, SIO DS Chris Bell said, Michael, Kerry and Shannon Ives held positions of responsibility and should have shown Ethan love, care and protection. Instead, Michael caused distress, pain and misery to his grandson before brutally taking his life nearly 4 years ago in August 2021. Kerry and Shannon both watched, took no action as the abuse unfolded in the home that they all shared. Their behaviour was beyond comprehension, and it is impossible to imagine the terror a two-year-old would feel in suffering the horrific injuries he endured, inflicted upon him by those regarded as his closest family. Ethan's father, William Griffiths, he also spoke outside the court. He said, unfortunately, I did not get to spend much time with Ethan, but the time I had was precious. He will never be forgotten and will always live on in our hearts and our memories. But let's be honest, guys. It's just cold justice, isn't it, when it comes down to it? The UK system is such that these individuals will probably be free one day. Should they ever get to walk the streets freely, breathe free air, potentially harm other people? I don't believe so. I believe if you can torture, brutalise and in the end murder a 2-year-old toddler. Well, your freedom should be absolutely rescinded on every level. You'd have to spend the rest of your natural life in prison until you're carried out in a box. Ethan was a beautiful little boy, a 2-year-old little boy. He was starved. He was prevented from drinking, so he was dehydrated. He was violently aggressed, where he had multiple bleeds on his brain before finally receiving the blow that killed him. How is it possible that the human beings who do this to our babies in our society ever get to be free again? It plays on my mind. And more in the UK, I deeply worry about the abandoning of our children. As ever, I'd love to know your thoughts. Let me know in the comments. I read them all. And most importantly, it reminds me that in spite of those frustrations I have, the average human being feels exactly the same as I do. And that's heartening to me and it's reinforcing for me. So please let me know. Do you think that these individuals should ever get to walk the streets freely again? Look after yourselves, guys. This is absolutely dedicated to that gorgeous little toddler who should be playing freely with friends and looking forward to a future he deserved. See you again next time. Be safe.